This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Alrighty, now the torture part of the evening. So we were talking in the break previously about inspirations for that fabulous rickshaw chase of yours. So there's some mention of Indiana Jones, but it seemed to me that Raffles was quite an important part of your character. Is that the case?
I think Dash in particular is one of those composites of the classic colonial British adventurer who's not actually very good at being a colonial adventurer. Raffles was part of the inspiration, and actually having been to Singapore in the Raffles Hotel there as well, there's a great big statue of Edward Raffles, which provided a lot of the physical inspiration, but it's mostly characters like Flashman, Indiana Jones to no small extent, and a lot of the classic pulp fiction novels of the 1950s, which I grew up reading far too many of. That's really the inspiration for Dash. And the fact I just like writing cats.
Yes, well, I shall try and psychoanalyze that. Obviously, that's just one small part of the novel. I didn't notice any particularly speculative fiction elements in it. Is it just a historical novel, or are weird things likely to happen?
No, things definitely get weirder. Glastonbury explodes at one point. carrying on the tradition for blowing up local landmarks. Glastonbury explodes. Eventually, there's a giant invasion by the Unseelie. People get chased by various bits and bobs from British folklore, and there's airship chases and all kinds of steampunk staples. Just not too many other than the HMS Endymion currently in Shanghai at the moment.
I must say, that sounds absolutely splendid, old chap. Certainly looking forward to reading that. Ross, your novel appears to be based in another world entirely, but there was a mention of a suspension bridge in there. Was that supposed to be familiar?
Yes, I've actually flip-flopped quite several times with this novel on setting it in Bristol versus setting it in this imaginary world that's not quite Bristol. And I did plump for the imaginary world in the end, but it is an analogue. It's not quite alt history, it does get a bit stranger than that. But yes, there's a lot of Bristol in there.
I'm certainly interested to learn more about these mysterious statues that stood outside the house that Greta has apparently left there, or possibly stolen from somewhere and abandoned there. Can you tell us any more about it?
The statues are pretty key to the whole thing. Greta is a sculptor, and she's able to make these statues because she's got a bit of interdimensional technology that she's not supposed to have.
Alright, that's probably quite enough spoilers, but again, certainly looking forward to reading that one in due course. Has anybody got any questions for either Scott or Roz? Rosie, I'm afraid, has had to rush up and catch your train, so we can't torture her any further. Well done, Justin. I'm going to cry on you.
In the absence of anybody else asking one, this is kind of more a technical question for both you guys. Just interesting that both your chapters were chapter 2. And I find as an author that chapter 2 is actually quite a difficult chapter to write, on the basis that usually chapter 1 writes itself, because you've got a blank sheet of paper, bash, it goes down. But chapter 2 needs, I always find, a lot more thought than possibly any other chapter until the end. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts, considerations, ruminations about that technical aspect of writing a chapter 2.
It can be a yes or no.
Okay. I was trying to palm that off on Roz with the whole ladies first thing, but it didn't work. Chapter 2 for me, particularly in Etherjack, takes place on the other side of the world to the main crux of the story. So it's a complete divergence from what actually happened in chapter 1. You go from Glastonbury to Shanghai. And I wanted to set the pace of the novel. There's a lot of... When it's set in the UK, the parts are set in the UK, took a while to get rolling because it, you know, building up the tension, setting the scene. But I wanted to. Dash is an ancillary character. He's not one of the main. He's not the main character, not by a long shot. But what he is he's the foil. He's the foil. He's almost the comic relief, if you will. The generally inept, bumbling British adventurer. And I wanted to establish that element of his character straight away. But I also wanted to do something. I wanted to do a chase scene. Purely for my own. Because I've never written one. But I couldn't have cars. Didn't really want to do. He was running. And then the other guy was running behind him. And then the other guy was running. And one day I was saying, Rickshaws! And it just kind of wrote itself again. It wrote itself from there. And I enjoyed chapter two. It's probably so far one of my favourite chapters to write because it's so different to the rest of the book.
Rose?
Okay, this won't help you at all, but this was actually my first chapter. And the chapter that is now chapter one was one that I wrote much later because I decided that I wanted to introduce, I have two protagonists and I wanted to introduce the other one first. So this was the one that wrote itself. And so I've kind of sidestepped the whole chapter two issue. Well, I'm just switching from one protagonist to another.
I have two protagonists. But do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and structurally I think it is, chapter two has to carry an awful lot of weight. And so my chapter one is, it's action-y, it's mysterious, it asks a lot of questions it doesn't answer. And then chapter two has to be a lot more grounded and solid. And that might not have sounded like it, but compared to chapter one, believe me, chapter one is much more like, what the fuck's going on? And so, and this one, and it does need to set the tone and it needs to foreshadow. I think if you put too much foreshadowing in your first chapter, it can pull it down. But you need to start making sure that you've got pointers to everything else that's happening through the rest of the novel in your second chapter. So yeah, it tends to be quite cerebral. And I have had to go back and put that stuff in here once I decided to move it to chapter two.
Any other questions for our willing or not so willing victims? Don't scratch your nose, Kevin. I think you're putting your hand up.
Hands down.
You're bidding. You don't know what for yet.
Anybody else? Well, in which case, I'm going to follow that up and say that what about all this outlining stuff that we keep hearing about? That surely you have all of the chapters plotted out in advance.
When I first sat down to write Applejack, I wrote a page that said, this is what's going to happen. It took me about 3 days of writing to realise that entire page was completely pointless. Because it's just evolving as the characters are evolving and things, and I'm coming up with stupid ideas that sound really, really good at the time. It just keeps changing. It's all about the fourth iteration of the plot now. And while the general crux has been there and the Glastonbury, you know, is exploding, the next two sections of the next two sections of the trilogy are permanently in flux. I haven't even started writing the skeleton of those yet. So, no, with me it's just taking it as it comes. There's a definite beginning, there's a definite end. Whatever happens in the middle depends on the whims of fate and whiskey.
Ross, you've been professionally trained. Tell me there's something to all these people who talk about having their walls covered with post-it notes to organise their plot.
Yeah, no, I do. I do the post-it note thing. I do. I have rolls of wallpaper lining paper that I unroll and I stick the post-it notes to them and I draw big arrows and I stick things on and then I tear it all down again and start again because... Scott's right, you have ideas and sometimes you can't throw the ideas away and you think, that doesn't fit, it doesn't work and I have to change everything and you think, bloody hell, I'm just going to have to change everything. So no, I mean this novel, I wrote a page of plan and then I seated the pants stick from start to finish just writing one character's story. And so I had that in kind of rough scenes, and then I realised, having done all of that, that actually another one of my characters was the one that I really cared about, and I wanted to bring her to the front, and that's why I then went back and wrote the whole novel again, pretty much from her point of view, and then interspersing the two points of view. And if you really want to know how to structure a novel properly before you start, talk to her, because she's actually succeeded in doing it.
That would be you, Jo.
I basically do it the same as Scott, is I have a beginning and I have an end, and I have four or five things that I know have to happen in the middle of the story, and all the stuff in between I make up as I go along. So I haven't been professionally trained.
Whatever works for you.
The myth
drops.
I'm going to make good on that bit. I'm going to make good on that bit.
Kevin.
Okay, so definite beginning, definite end. What about definite date?
For finishing it, you mean?
Yes. Can I use the F word here? Finish.
Yeah.
I mean, is that okay?
We've already got an explicit tag, thanks to Ross.
I'm intrigued as to, you know, your relationship with time on this one.
This, of course, for those of you on the podcast, is because Kevlin is a flash fiction writer, and he never has to worry about finishing things.
That's not my problem.
What may come as a surprise to anyone who's actually heard me talk about this bloody novel for the last year and a half is I'm a journalist by trade. So writing deadlines to me are gospel. This is happening by this date. The problem is, with a novel, you're imposing them on yourself. So I started writing Etherjack in December 2012. And I said, I'll have it finished by March 2013, because I'm going away. I thought, 4 months, I can sit and write for 4 months and not have a life. I had a life. Then I went away with work for six months, and thought, I'll do it while I'm away, because I'll come home from work, I won't know anyone know where I am, I can sit and... I didn't. And since then, I had 2 months off work. Fantastic! I can write. Nah, because again, things just keep happening. And when you're not a professional author, when you're writing something like this as a labour of love, unfortunately, you have to do that thing called paying the bills, and that's taken far too much of a priority for me. Do I have a definite finish date? Yes. Will I finish it at that date? Probably not.
Every time Scott comes back in February, goes, right, I'm going to finish it.
The scary thing about this is that what Scott says about writing novels sounds very much like me trying to write short stories. But hopefully, Ross will have the finish date.
You wish. I started writing Luminous in November 2012. And I thought, snip, I'll do this in 3 months, maybe six, it'll be great. And I've actually not had to go out to work and pay the bills, because I half killed myself the previous 2 years doing a really silly job, which actually meant that I had enough money this year to concentrate on the writing. But I'm just really slow. I'm really slow. And I like writing short stories as well, so I get distracted, and there are some people around here who are responsible for some additional short story distraction, please. I like writing the short stories purely because you can finish something. Yeah. And the novel, after a while, it does get really, really wearing to think, how long have I been doing this? You get fed up. You get fed up with the characters, you hate them. And there's a lot to be said for having somebody give you a deadline that you've got to work to, and I long for the day when anybody cares enough to say, turn this around in 6 months or we'll beat you with a stick. I would love that to happen.
Yeah, I was just thinking, if you think chapter two is hard, when you've taken 4 years to write a novel, when you finally sell it and the publisher says, and we also want to buy a sequel and we need that in 6 months' time. Anyway, any more questions for our two lovely readers? No? Okay. Well, next month we have for you some flash fiction, and I believe Kevin is organising all this for us. So
I feel a buck being
he will tell us a little bit about what we can expect.
Right, what can we expect? We're going to do a slight shift. Instead of having two or three authors, reading extracts of longer works. We are going for complete works, nothing longer than 1,000 words. We have 8 readers, 4 of whom are actually in the room at the moment. Me, Cheryl, Pete and Justin, and we have 4 other victims. I mean, readers. Let's see, Jonathan Pinnock, Gareth Powell, Louise Gethin and Pauline Mazura. So basically a feast. It's more like a sort of a buffet. You know, rather than sort of like a series of like, yeah, exactly. It's tapas fiction. That's what we're going for. And we, you know, if you're not sure about something, there'll be another thing along in 5 minutes. That's the basic model. So that's the 14th of April.
So slightly earlier next month, for the benefit of anybody who's planning to rush off for the Easter holidays or to do Easter con or anything like that. And yes, you did hear correctly. We are going to have the fabulous Mr. Gareth L. Powell back again next month. And you can all listen to Gareth and then run away before I get a chance to run. Any other items that we need to talk about? People want to buy airships, people want to buy tickets for the airship ball. And for those of you who... Ros?
I just want to say, I don't know if anyone here is thinking about buying an airship ball ticket still, but if you want a picnic ticket, i.e. to be there for the entire evening and not miss John's talk about the steam-powered war elephant, then you do need to let us know in advance because we've got to order the catering, so don't leave it till the last minute.
Yes, steam-powered war elephants. Programmable steam-powered war elephants, even. We are definitely looking forward to. Okay, and just a final reminder for those of you who came in late Wednesday night, Foils, Karen Joy Fowler, fabulous American writer, 2 Nebula Awards, 3 World Fantasy Awards, Shirley Jackson Award, current novel up for Nebula, and the American version of the Bookers. So very much hope to see some of you at Foils on Wednesday night. Thank you very much, everybody.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.